Coming up, the contentious debate over banning U.S. courts from considering Islamic law, Sharia, in their decision-making. Plus, an Episcopal congregation chooses to become Catholic.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. As the conflict in Syria continues to escalate, the UN and faith-based relief agencies are calling attention to a growing humanitarian crisis. Some 200,000 residents are believed to have fled the fighting in Aleppo, Syria's largest city. The UN's World Food Program sounded an early alarm this week, saying 3 million people will need food assistance in the next 12 months, more than 10% of Syria's 22 million people. The State Department's annual report on religious freedom is out and draws particular attention to the plight of religious minorities in several nations. Among those mentioned, Christians in Egypt, Ahmadi Muslims in Indonesia and Pakistan, and Sufis and Baha'is in Iran. The report says Jews suffer in several countries, as do Muslims, including those in Europe and China, which was also cited for its treatment of Tibetan Buddhists. An official Chinese response blasted the report as, quote, blatantly interfering in the internal affairs of other countries. This year's State Department list includes the same countries that appeared the year before. The countries of particular concern include Saudi Arabia, Burma, and North Korea. A coalition of African-American pastors urged African-Americans to rethink voting for President Obama because of his support for gay marriage. At a Washington press conference on Tuesday, the pastors accused the president of pandering to the gay community and taking black voters for granted.
I am ashamed that the first black president chose this road, a disgraceful road.
New figures from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life show a majority, 51% of African Americans, remain opposed to gay marriage. 40% are in favor. There's been little change in those numbers since April, before President Obama voiced his personal support for gay marriage. Meanwhile, another Pew survey shows that a majority of American Catholics shares their bishop's concerns about some Obama administration policies that they say infringe on religious liberty. But a majority of Catholics also plans to vote for President Obama. 56% of Catholics say they agree with the bishop's stance. At the same time, 51% of Catholic voters say they support or lean toward supporting the president. 42% say Mitt Romney. Also this week, Romney launched a new effort to court Jewish voters, emphasizing his strong support for Israel. A group of Christian leaders this week denounced congressional efforts to cut federal funding for tax credits that benefit the poor. They spoke in advance of a House vote that reduced the current rate of the earned income and child tax credits while extending the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy. They call the proposed policy morally reprehensible.
Caviar for the wealthy, crumbs from the table for the children, these are not family values. They are faithless, immoral values, an affront to people of every faith.
Now, a special report. In many areas of the country, intense legislative battles are being waged over Islamic law, or Sharia. Bills have been introduced in more than 20 states to ban courts from considering foreign laws, including Sharia. Proponents say it's a matter of national security, but others allege that Muslims are being unfairly targeted. Kim Lawton has the story.
We can have a will compliant with Sharia with no problem.
At the Awad and Khoury law offices near Newark, New Jersey, attorney Abed Awad consults with Muslims about creating contracts, wills, and other legal documents that adhere to the principles of Sharia, Islamic law. And that's important to Muslims like Asif Mustafa.
The way of Sharia means that there's a guideline for how I should be interacting or doing commerce.
Awad says over the past decade, he's handled more than 100 cases that have involved some component of Islamic law. Now a growing movement seeks to ban state courts from considering Sharia in any way. Awad says this would restrict his ability to litigate cases and judges' ability to decide them.
These things will trickle down to your average American Muslim when it comes to distributing his estate, getting married, issues regarding their dissolution of marriage. This is divesting courts of their own authority.
But proponents say legislation is necessary to protect American interests. Karen Lugo is an attorney and anti-Sharia activist.
The problem is that within a society, a Western culture, you cannot have two prevailing legal systems side by side. Ultimately, there will be a breakdown of what we in our country have agreed to be governed by, which is this consent to live under a rule of law, not of men, not of clerics.
Sharia is an Arabic word that means path to the watering hole. For Muslims, Sharia is the divine law revealed in the Quran.
Sharia is a methodology to engage in the divine text, to ascertain divine will. It's constantly in flux. It's evolving. It's very flexible.
The other meaning of Sharia, which is the more common, is this human interpretation of divine law, which is then codified into laws and differs from country to country. And generally, when we're talking about Sharia or even criticizing it, we tend to be thinking of the human interpretation.
The bulk of Sharia deals with topics surrounding worship, diet, family relationships, and financial transactions. But there are also principles for political order, crime, and punishment, and how these have been interpreted and applied in many predominantly Muslim countries raises concerns here in the U.S. David Yerushalmi, an attorney and Orthodox Jew, is one of the most prominent and controversial voices in the anti-Sharia movement.
If you look at the actual doctrine that the Mujahideen, the various jihadists around the globe, say drives their jihad against the West, it is Sharia law and its doctrine of jihad. If we are to take them seriously, and I would, of course, suggest that we ought to, that becomes a national security threat.
Some people who've lived in countries where Sharia is the basis of law agree.
It's really time for the West to understand what are the consequences of welcoming Sharia or even saying that Sharia is misunderstood. There is nothing misunderstood about a law that condemns women to stoning, to death, and to flogging.
There's been a contentious Sharia debate across the country. In 2010, voters in Oklahoma passed an initiative to ban state courts from considering Sharia. But a court challenge has so far prevented it from taking effect. Activists are now supporting bills that don't explicitly mention Sharia, but instead ban courts from considering any foreign law. Four states have now enacted such laws, and similar bills have been taken up in more than 20 other states. Yerushalmi wrote a widely used model bill called American Laws for American Courts.
It doesn't identify Sharia per se, but because it doesn't have to, although Sharia is certainly incorporated within its reach. It says any foreign law or foreign judgment that would violate in the particular case at issue a fundamental constitutional liberty of one of the parties, due process, equal protection, the court will not grant it recognition.
Aziza Al-Hibri is professor emeritus at the University of Richmond Law School and founder of Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights. She says she too is concerned by how Sharia has been interpreted and implemented in some places, especially overseas against women, arguing that it is not a true representation of Islam. Still, Al-Hibri says anti-Sharia legislation is unnecessary.
Our Constitution basically trumps everything else. And that also goes on the state level with the state law. You don't just bring a law from another country and impose it here if it is against public policy. That's not how we work here.
We can have a valid polygamous marriage out of Egypt. And if this polygamous marriage is brought to the United States and the court is requested to enforce Egyptian law, which would permit polygamy, but that violates our public policy. So a U.S. court would not recognize it.
Awad, who also teaches at Rutgers Law School and Pace Law School, says the circumstances where Sharia is relevant in U.S. courts are limited, mainly to providing additional information for a judge reviewing, for example, a contract that follows Sharia financial guidelines.
He applies basic New Jersey contract law. So he's not really enforcing Sharia. Sharia is just a tool to aid the court to better understand what it is reviewing.
Awad says anti-foreign law bills could affect other religious groups as well.
This vast net that is being cast to prevent state judges from considering any foreign law is catching in its net Jewish law, canon law.
Interfaith groups, including many Jewish groups, have also been vocally opposed to the legislation.
We refuse to be divided along religious lines. It is what is at stake in this debate over Sharia law. And I'm proud to stand with all of you and with my colleagues here to say that is simply un-American at the deepest and most profound level.
Anti-Sharia activists contend that Islamic law has been used in unfair decisions against women, especially in domestic cases. In the most frequently cited case, a New Jersey woman tried to get a restraining order against her husband, alleging that he raped and beat her. After hearing testimony that the husband's Muslim faith obligates wives to have sex with their husbands, the judge denied the restraining order. Many Muslims agree that was a mistake.
Muslims were upset because we don't believe that, especially women, that God permits the man to beat the wife. Human rights activists were upset. Constitutional scholars were upset. Everybody was upset. And you know who was upset as well? The appellate court, which immediately reversed that decision because it was a bad decision.
The woman happened to have an attorney, and she happened to have sufficient funds to make an appeal. And only then was it corrected. Well, how many women like this woman, who can't afford an appeal?
Muslims around the country say the legislative efforts discriminate against them.
It is to create this fear of Islam and Muslims in the larger society that, oh, Islam does not belong in America, these are foreigners, don't trust them.
The Islamic Circle of North America, ICNA, has launched a national multi-million dollar campaign to counter what it believes are negative misperceptions about Sharia. The campaign features billboards, informational mailings, and community forums about what Sharia is and is not.
Thank you for calling 1-855-SHARIA. How can I help you?
ICNA has also set up a toll-free hotline where Muslims and non-Muslims can call to ask questions about Sharia or get information about the push for legislation.
They can say that it is anti-foreign law, but we know it is targeting one community, one faith.
Is not the Sharia doctrine part of the jihadist doctrine? The moment you begin to just ask the question and engage in a real discourse, you become branded as an Islamophobe, and they attack you and they attack you.
Anti-Sharia proponents say they intend to keep up the pressure on the local level.
If the law doesn't pass, it engages enormous debate because the opposition has put the brakes on, but that means that it comes up again at the next session. And there's another public debate.
Al-Hibri's group, Karama, has been sponsoring town hall meetings to make sure the public debate includes Islamic law experts. She says open dialogue and education are the only way to resolve the conflict.
The Muslims should not live in fear, and the non-Muslims should not live in fear. This is a country which is based on courage, on production, on trust in each other, and if we need to talk about it, let's talk about it and get over any Islamophobia, which is unjustified.
But given the level of polarization, resolution isn't likely anytime soon. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Next, finding one's place in a worship house divided. The Episcopal Church is a branch of the Church of England, which broke away from Rome in 1534. The American Church has itself been divided, primarily over issues related to homosexuality. we have a report about Episcopalians who are taking up an invitation from Rome to make the Catholic Church their home. Our correspondent is Bob Fall.
Have mercy upon me, O God.
In Bladensburg, Maryland, the Catholic service unfolds smoothly, a comfortable routine for priests and parishioners alike. But 1 year ago, members of St. Luke's Parish were devout, devoted Episcopalians. This is the first Episcopal church in the country to convert to Catholicism under Vatican rules designed to attract disaffected Episcopalians.
Father, 20 years ago, if I had told you you would become a Catholic priest, what would you have said?
I would have thought you were crazy.
Under a 2009 decree by Pope Benedict XVI, St. Luke's, like all Episcopal churches that choose to convert, gets to retain much of its liturgy and traditions, like using its Book of Common Prayer and Anglican hymns. It also gets to keep its married priest, Father Mark Lewis, who is exempt from the Roman Catholic vows of celibacy. Father Lewis, an Episcopal priest for 10 years, and his wife Vicky, have two children. Their grandson Sherman is an altar server.
We left the Episcopal Church not because we were running away from the issues of the Episcopal Church. We left the Episcopal Church because we were running to the Catholic Church. We came to a point where we realized that the theology of the Episcopal Church is what is lacking. The theology of Rome and the unity of Rome, the unity in the Holy See and in the bishops, that was appealing to us.
We beseech thee then, O Lord.
Former Episcopal priest Father Scott Hurd, married with three children, also found the move to Catholicism seamless. He was ordained into the Catholic Church in 2000 and acted as the chaplain here while Father Lewis waited to be ordained.
There is a real hunger among some Episcopalians and Anglicans for authority. It was the question of where can true Christian authority be found that was a key element in this community's journey.
It wasn't just the need for authority, say other former Episcopalians. They were also uncomfortable because the Episcopal Church approves of ordaining women, openly gay priests, and same-sex marriage.
There's not any one real incident that you can point to, but it's like the strands of a rope giving one by one, and each one weakens the rope as a whole.
Anne Marie Whitaker feels that she didn't leave the Episcopal Church, that the church left her.
All of a sudden, it was a do-your-own-thing mass. And there was a lot that was going on. For instance, a clown mass. I would come in and someone put a red nose on me. I saw children circling altars. One by one, parishes started to succumb to some of these practices in order to attract people. And it made it difficult for me to worship in that atmosphere.
Under the new Vatican guidelines, an estimated 1,300 Anglicans and 150 married priests have inquired about being received into the Catholic Church. To accommodate them, the Church has established a new ordinariate, the equivalent of a nationwide diocese. Father Hurd acts as its chief of staff.
I don't see it as being a tidal wave, but I see it as a slow and steady trickle of people who feel led to come in this direction.
And people who feel led despite revelations of widespread priestly pedophilia and cover-up within the Catholic Church.
I was outraged with these scandals with the priests. And then recently I sat down and they said, what about Penn State? What about Penn State? Is this something that is happening all around? It's not to excuse the church.
But it's bigger than the church.
It's bigger than the church.
There has always been scandals in the church. There has been heretics in the church from the very beginning. And there's been sin in the church. And as I said in my sermon this morning, what makes the church holy is that it's the church of Christ. And that is what I choose to focus on, rather than the sinful nature of people.
Some Episcopal Church leaders, such as Bishop Eugene Sutton of the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland, argue that these conversions are not a threat, that many Catholics become Episcopalian.
I like to say that we are really one spiritual family. We believe about 90% of things in common. Where we disagree is on matters of authority and some other spiritual matters. But the important thing is that we are not fighting. We are not in competition with one another.
Even though the number of Episcopal congregations converting to Catholicism has been relatively small, the impact on the Episcopal Church has not been negligible. Indeed, here at Virginia Theological Seminary, the country's largest Episcopal seminary, the president and dean calls the movement a real threat.
There's quite a lot of traffic currently going both ways between the two traditions, especially at the level of congregants. What's interesting here is you've got entire congregations and clergy making the shift. So, yeah, I think the Roman Catholic Church is a threat because we've lost the sense of our theological understanding and identity.
Dean Markham believes that among Episcopalians, there is still anger over the Pope's 2009 decree.
There was a perception that this was poaching by the Roman Catholic Church of Anglicans around the world. It was discourteous, it was stealing sheep. It's viewed as not recognizing the value of and integrity of our tradition.
Conversion, then, is a touchy issue, which newfound Catholics handle both diplomatically and bluntly.
We're not trying to steal sheep or to poach. We're trying to pastorally respond to those who've wanted to come in this direction for some time.
Let me tell you something about sheep stealing. You cannot steal sheep if the shepherd is doing his job. And that's bottom line. If the shepherd is doing his job, the flock will stay.
Have mercy upon us.
Whether poaching or a natural evolution, Episcopalians troubled by what's happened at St. Luke's and elsewhere argue that their church simply cannot sit back and watch.
I think this could be quite a healthy movement for the Episcopal Church, because what it does is it keeps the Episcopal Church focused on providing a theological rationale for the things that we do. Too often we couch our changes in terms of polity or positioning on questions like sexuality in terms of secular discourse. And we as a tradition need to be as self-confident as Roman Catholics are. And we need to be equally robust in saying, look, we actually think we have discerned what God requires of us as a community in the world. And we need to put our vision up against the Catholic vision.
While some Episcopal leaders have made conversion difficult, that was not the case here at St. Luke's. Under generous terms, this parish gets to keep its building. But however the conversion is handled, church leaders see little need to back down from where the Episcopal Church stands on social issues.
One thing that the Episcopal Church does that is very attractive to people is that we try to do two things at once, and that is hold on to the ancient past. We believe in tradition. But the other thing we do well is embrace the new. We do not believe that in order to follow Jesus means that we have to have our head in the sand and we cannot be open to any new understanding or any new way of being church.
For new converts, though, it is that very tension between embracing both the old and the new which has caused them to turn in a new direction.
It was a move to going to what we believe is truth and what we know is truth. And I don't think there's anybody alive that would know what truth is and not move to it.
It is going home. It really is. And it feels good. And everyone's been so very helpful, but I'm at peace. I'm at peace.
Here, where going home has brought comfort to a small congregation and implications for the wider Episcopal Church. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faugh in Bladensburg, Maryland.
On our calendar this week, on Friday, Hindus celebrate Krishna Janmashtami, which marks the birthday of the popular Hindu deity Lord Krishna. Finally, tens of thousands of Jewish men and women gathered at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey this week to celebrate the completion of 7.5 years of study one page a day of the Talmud, the more than 2,700 pages of rabbinic commentary on the Torah and Jewish law. This is the 12th time Jews around the world have participated in the Page a Day program, which began in Europe in 1923. Organizers said this year's celebration was the largest. That's our program for now. I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on smartphones. There's always much more on our website as well. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from a recent concert given for Pope Benedict XVI by an orchestra of Palestinian and Israeli musicians.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.